At the University of Wisconsin, years ago, a group of young men with writing talent formed a literary club to promote their ambitions. They decided that when a member read a story or a poem, no punches were to be pulled. Each manuscript was to be dissected without mercy. The sessions got to be so brutal, as each tried to outdo the others in harsh criticism, that they decided to call themselves the Stranglers. And then, since this group was strictly masculine, the co-eds decided to form their own literary club. They set up the same way, except that they resolved to be as positive in their criticism as they could and still be honest and helpful. About 20 years later, an alumnus decided to make an analysis of his classmates' careers. It turned out that of all the bright talent in the Stranglers, not one had made a literary reputation. Out of the other group, half a dozen successful writers came, led by Marjorie Kennan Rawlings, who wrote The Yearling. It may, of course, have been simple coincidence and nothing else, but you wonder if perhaps the first group may not have made a basic mistake. So destructive, so top-heavy with adverse criticism, that everybody decided on a different career, or else wrote with so little self-confidence that the writing was weak. The young women encouraged each other, and several of them blossomed. If the Phillips translation of 1 Corinthians 13 had been around in those days, the women would have liked it, because it has Paul say that love looks for a way of being constructive. Not that it will try to be constructive if an opportunity happens to come along, but that it goes out looking for the chance to be creative. As the wedding consultant and pianist at this church know all too well, I remind people in marriage ceremonies that the power of love to be creative is probably the greatest challenge in their future. That what each one of them turns out to be years from now will depend partly on what the other has made him or her to be, that living together, they are actually engaged in the process of creating one another. I don't know whether they believe me or not, or whether the words even register, but if they did, I think they'd all be a little more careful about input into somebody else's life. I have the feeling sometimes at a wedding, when I make such a comment, that a disgruntled marriage partner has just looked over at the other and thought, "You mean I'm responsible for that?" And the answer, however painful, is yes, to some degree, you are. For better or worse, a little or a lot, we are involved in creating the people we live with. It's especially true of children who flourish in an atmosphere of affection and trust. A man I've been reading lately opened a book in the library of one of his college classmates who had made quite a mark for himself. The book was a birthday gift from the boy's mother, and it was inscribed, "With love and pride for my son, who has done great things and will do greater yet." There isn't any way to measure that kind of constructive affection, but I'm convinced that it was an important element in his success. We tend to become what people predict for us. We tend to perform the way people expect we will perform. And I always think, when I say something like this, of a dear friend of mine in another church who spent half his life trying to get over the conviction that he was what his father called him as a child: slow and dumb. It was like a ball and chain on his personality. He finally cut loose from it, but by then he was past 40. I don't have to look far to see how that works, because I have a curious, if somewhat trivial, proof in my own experience. I used to play half-court basketball at noon with a group of close and cherished friends who had met together to play for several years. Our friendship was far more important to us than who won. So we developed the habit of complimenting one another generously and overlooking mistakes. I felt perfectly at home on that court and with those friends, and the result was that my limited skills did not embarrass me. I actually played a little better, surrounded by trust and affection, than I had ever played anywhere else. But on occasion, I would go among strangers who judged me differently, and I would invariably react by playing much worse than usual. All of us respond to the expectations people have of us, which makes it pretty silly to say that we don't care what people think. Like it or not, what they think of us will have a measurable effect on what we become. Sometimes when we hear a mother or father talk about a child, or a husband or wife express their great faith in one another, we smile and say, well, love is obviously blind. It may be truer to say that love has visions that escape the rest of us. The way a mother sees her son may not correspond to our logic or anybody's logic, but it has redeemed a great many sons. The way Christ saw the fisherman Peter may have seemed ludicrous to some of his friends, but the fact is that Peter became what Christ thought he was. Love can create, often, what isn't there yet. It sees the future and then causes that future to happen. It only works, of course, where people love themselves first, not egotistically or with a sad little case of conceit, but with a realistic and half-humorous kind of self-acceptance. You look into the mirror, confess ruefully that you may not be the easiest person on earth to love, but that you love yourself anyway. and you'll try to do good things for yourself, and then you turn from that mirror to a window. From loving what you see inside to what you see outside. Jesus knew perfectly well what he was about when he spoke of loving our neighbors in the way we love ourselves. If we don't arrive at a wise love of self, we cannot love anyone else. I like something Alan Fromm said in a book called The Ability to Love. He points out that the person who wisely loves herself does not assume in advance that the world will consider her unkind or untrustworthy or try to take advantage of her. Why should they want to do this? She is, after all, a nice person. So she goes into the world expecting to be received that way and then proceeds to forget about herself and be interested in other people. I happen to be extremely fond of the poetry of Robert Frost. I used to think of him when I was in college as a gentle, sensitive, loving man, but some recent biographers claim that this was certainly not true. There are those who say that he was an absolute tyrant to the people closest, that his children disliked him, as did others in his personal circle of family and friends, that he was grouchy, insulting, and almost impossible to live with. If this is true, then Robert Frost must have had just about everything any would-be writer could want, except a deep down sense of loving and being loved. It apparently made him feel like nothing at times. And when one feels like that, he turns on others. Surely you have noticed that on those occasions when you hate yourself, you are cruel to others. And for no good reason but to vent your own bad feelings. We're talking at great length this winter about agape love, that special kind of love described in the New Testament and nowhere described so fully as it is by Paul in the verses we are reading. It is, according to that brilliant man, the highest gift that can come to a human being. But we must admit, even as we talk about it, that loving will always involve a certain amount of blundering. It's possible to be too idealistic about love. It's wrong to think that we can't hurt the people we love, or that those who truly love us will not sometimes hurt us. They will. And sometimes it will even be intentional, because people are not always at their best. A man named Philip Kuhnhart wrote a book called My Father's House, a true account of his childhood. He idolized his father, and when he was still young, he wrote an essay on the perfect father-son relationship as he saw it then. He said that mothers were nice, quite important, but not like fathers, at least to a boy. And in his essay, he had this comment about a father. He should not always be available like a mother, for this would destroy his brilliance. By going to work all day, it makes the nights when you see him much more important, and the weekends golden. Do you catch an element of rationalization and fear in that remark? Is there an undercurrent of defensiveness about a father who could not or would not spend much time with him? Is there fear present, as if the writer were saying that he would not want to see his father at close range too often for fear this might mar the father's image? Maybe in this case it would have, because it almost sounds as if this boy is in love with a dream and not a person. The words are lovely, but they might be even lovelier and more reassuring if the son could have said, "I think my father is wonderful in spite of his faults." Maybe I'm only saying that because I have no other hope as a father. If my children, and I throw this in after your chuckle, like yours, are ever to express a deep and honest affection, it will have to be with the realistic postscript added, "in spite of all his faults." I wonder sometimes why it should be so hard for people to put it that way, because none of us has ever met anyone who was free from fault. If we are going to love anyone, it will have to be in spite of imperfection. I've always rather liked it when my children devised some colorful nickname descriptive of a personality defect or a physical blemish or some memorable blunder of mine, because it seemed to me that the memory of our having laughed together might someday be more useful to them than any pretension that I was better than I really was. We don't experience perfect loves, even if Hollywood does try to convince us otherwise. We fail people, and they fail us, but it's redeemable if we can figure out ways to make even the failures creative. Paul, after all, wrote his great words about love for people, not for God. And people cannot love each other with the perfection of God. No one knew that better than Paul. But he also believed that with all our limitations, we can be amazingly creative in loving, transforming, enriching other people. Emerson, who could so well put things into a nutshell, summed up Paul's idea: "Our chief want in life is somebody who shall make us do what we can." That somebody, I think, will always be somebody who loves and trusts us until what is believed becomes a fact. Somebody has probably done that already for you. It's your obligation now to do it for someone else. Startle and surprise us, O God, with the idea that we too are creators. Amen.